All right. Hey, thanks for taking the time to join me today. It's great to see you again. Can you just so everyone knows who you are, can you tell us your name and what you do for a living?
Of course. Thank you, Tom, for having me here. And my name is Evandro Nunes. I train jiu-jitsu, for 15, 16 years now. And currently, I am the lead instructor of the Grace Survival Tactics program that we have at Grace University, which is responsible for teaching defensive tactics instructors to share jiu-jitsu and defensive tactics with their department. So we're responsible for, let's say, over 1,000 officers certified by us per year, and we've been doing that for the last 25 years.
Okay, so you train police officers who train police officers in defensive tactics
Exactly.
to integrate jiu-jitsu techniques into their defensive tactics training. Can you tell
Yes.
us, so what led you to study jiu-jitsu in the first place? You said about 15 years ago. What led you to study jiu-jitsu?
Yes, I'm from Brazil, and Brazil, it's a very interesting place. Society works very different over there, on the sense that the police is there to help society, but there's a lot of street fights and conflicts on the streets that the civilian himself or herself has to deal with. Therefore, I was exposed to a lot of street fights when I was younger, and learning on the street, fighting on the streets, and just realizing that even though I was fighting for what was right, I was still losing some fights. And I was like, man, this doesn't make sense. If I do what is right, I should win. That was in my mind. But then that was not how it happened. And I realized that I have to learn how to defend myself. So I started training Vale Tudo, which is the old MMA. And then with that, I got introduced to Jiu-Jitsu, which is a very effective martial art. And because I was younger and weaker than everyone else that I knew, it was working for me so effectively that I started devoting only and specifically to jiu-jitsu, and I trained forever, and here I am now in America doing what I love.
So everyone I've talked to is either an expert in their field or becoming
Okay.
expert in their field. And I wanted to speak with you because you're an expert. And you learned this over 15 years. Like, just so people have an idea of how much time you devote. So in the peak of your competing years, how many hours per week would you spend either thinking about jiu-jitsu, watching jiu-jitsu, training jiu-jitsu?
That's a good question, Tom. I cannot answer that question. There's no amount of hours. It's like it's the University of Jiu-Jitsu that I subscribed, which is love and passion through learning. It's every time, every second, every day, because either I'm training or I was resting from the training, thinking about the training, and then calling my friends and asking and talking about other trainings, or actually fighting on the street. So it's almost, it's hard to quantify. And I believe that that's where, when it's almost that there's an obsession over something that just consumes your life, because that's what you do. And then you wake up, oh, here we go, jiu-jitsu, and then when you're not doing those things in the beginning, you're kind of more learning, but then later you start teaching. So you add that to sharing jiu-jitsu with others, which also enhances your learning. So it's just, 15 years of passion towards, learning how to defend myself and how to teach other people to do the same thing.
And you were raised in a lineage. So for academics, they learn from professors and they trace that back. And
Yes.
you do the same in jiu-jitsu, correct? Who
Same
would
in
you trace
jiu-jitsu.
who would you attribute your learning to? Who
So
was your
jiu-jitsu, very briefly, a little bit of the story is that it's born in India, right? There's old texts about how the oldest martial arts came from India and then Japan and then eventually to Brazil. And in Brazil, jiu-jitsu was introduced to the Gracie family. And then Hélio Gracie and Carlos Gracie were responsible for modifying the old known as Japanese jiu-jitsu to what we call nowadays Brazilian jiu-jitsu or Gracie jiu-jitsu. So the Gracie family is responsible for that revolution and for also disseminating jiu-jitsu with the whole planet. So I learned in Brazil under one of the family members called Ryan Gracie. And then from there, I came to America and now I train under the grandsons of Hélio Gracie himself, which is Hiron Gracie and Henry Gracie. They are the ones that, I learned the most nowadays. And then that's the line, that's the quick line is very closest to the root that's possible. There's no, I could not be closer
Okay,
than where I am.
So you have this these long years of training. You can trace your lineage back through this through this family, and then what you do is tested. So you have to test this in competition. Can you talk a little bit about maybe some of the types of competitions where you've tested your skills that you've developed over these years?
Yes. So what I can say is that the true test of the martial art of the jiu-jitsu, it comes from your ability to defend yourself without fighting. That would be the transcended way of thinking it, right? Just once you have the ability to have so much confidence in yourself and you're so able to fight someone, they don't even need to fight and things can be de-escalated with verbal and just patience and forgiveness. That's the test that I would like to touch first. But to more physical or more graspable, or a way that is easier for people to grasp, I should say, is through tournaments. And I competed my whole life in Brazil, which is tough tournaments. And just every week I would compete and I would succeed in most of them, lose some of them, of course. And then I came to United States. I started competing on American Nationals and World Tournaments and Gi, No Gi, and then some special private events that back in the days were Metamoris or EBI, just some, you know, invited only events that people would invite like 12 people all over the planet. So that would be, you know, the line of proving myself to society that I'm good at jiu-jitsu. Local tournaments in Brazil, national tournaments in Brazil, national tournaments in America, world tournaments in America, and then the peak would be the private pay-per-view invited-only tournaments that we got invited to.
Okay, and I just wanted to, like, for people who aren't familiar with what you do, there's really nowhere to hide. You learn these skills, and it is what it is. Either you can do it or you can't.
Yes. That's the beauty of jiu-jitsu. There's no lying on the mat. There's no, I'm good because of this, and then you can do it verbally. No, at the end of the day, you grapple someone, and something will happen. And jiu-jitsu keeps people honest and keep people humble, because there's no way that you do a lucky strike or a lucky submission. No, if someone is better than you, they're going to dominate you until the day that you click them. And it's a beautiful game to play, and it's a beautiful, humble martial art.
And so what was it that brought you, so you began and developed your skills in Brazil. What was it that brought you to the U.S.?
Brought me to America, Tom, is the curiosity to know something beyond what I knew. So I remember my friends watching videos on the mat while we were training, and they would say, look at these world champions right here. They're so good. And they show me the videos, and I would look at those videos, Tom, and I would not be impressed. I was like, man, I think I can do that. But instead of saying that, I said, man, I want to go there, fight those people and see how it is. And out of curiosity, just to touch more people and to expose my ability to grapple with more people. I just want to see. I want to live that. And then I came, and then I happened to be successful in that field. And then I loved how America works regarding society. It's a fair society. It's a free society. There's a lot there. You know, arguably, Americans say that they have to improve. But in comparison to other countries or to Brazil specifically, where I came from, it's a whole different planet. The way the society works and the opportunity and the freedom. And if you work more, you receive more. And it's safe, you know. And, of course, we can always argue that there's some places that are dangerous. I get it. But overall, it's a free, safe place that I'm very grateful and happy to be part of. This country is amazing.
And I remember you talking about that, like coming to the United States and feeling this pressure. Can you talk a little bit about that pressure, that being safety, like the feeling of not having to necessarily watch your back?
Yes. The story that I think I told you is that when I was 23 years old, I was 23 when I came to America for the first time. And then I was in Miami training for a tournament called the ADCC. I was training actually a friend of mine that he was preparing for it. And then he came to me and he said, Evandro, what's your favorite thing about this country? And for the first time, I really sat on that question. I'm like, man, I don't know. Let me think. And then I realized that for the first time in my life in 23 years, I was not afraid of being robbed. And in Brazil, and I was not from the worst place in Brazil. I was very much middle class. My mom was working hard. My dad used to provide for us, you know, very hustle. But still, you're always watching over your objects and over your back. Everything is like a little jungle, you know. It's like survival of the fittest. And if you don't pay attention, you're gonna dance. So I was like, man, I feel safe. And that clicked the realization of gratitude. Just, man, I'm not afraid, you know, of imminent threat. And that, as you can imagine, can boost the quality of life of one person tremendously. And that's the irony, right? Because the very thing that fascinates about America, which is safety, it's not money, it's not the opportunities, even though those things are amazing, it's the safety aspect of it, which is why connects back so much to what we do, which is I'm giving jiu-jitsu back to law enforcement officers, which are the very people that keep me and everyone else safe, because we notice that there's a gap in their training, you know, that they can improve on. And it's just so fulfilling to give back to the very thing that I appreciate about this country.
And you talk about this, the safety, did that play a role? And well, actually, to back that up, I just to make a comment, I think that's something that people take for granted, especially people who live in safe countries. Like, we don't really think about the fact that, we could be unsafe. So I appreciated that story, because it reminded me that I quite often, everywhere I go, I feel safe. And so I appreciate that. Did that play a role in why you decided to want to train police officers, or was there some other reason? What made you decide you wanted to train police officers specifically?
I can for sure say that was part. It is part of it. That's why I'm saying it's so fulfilling for me to do what I do. But that was not a conscious decision. What naturally happened was that we have a Grace University programs for kids, and then a little older kids, then adults, women's only, self-defense. We have all kinds of programs. So once I mastered those programs, there's one specific program, which is the Gracie Survival Tactics, that we refer as GST, that only the Gracie family was teaching, which is Hiron, Horion back in the days, and then Hiron and Hanner. So it's a very protected program, because it's so important, it's so close to the source that they were not opening, there was no opening for people from outside to teach that curriculum. So I was the first person that was trusted with that curriculum to share jiu-jitsu with law enforcement. And I believe that the reason why is because it's hard to distinct what led me here, because it's the group, or it's the collective of me being grateful in this country, feeling, you know, being an expert on what I do, being eager to learn the teaching methodologies and the way and the lingo of law enforcement officers, having a certain kind of, not like when we go to teach officers, I'm not teaching officers. I'm not, you know, that's not the spirit. The spirit is like, man, I'm here with you guys. I'm so stoked that the law enforcement community opened a little window for us to share what changed our lives. So the approach, it's so unique, and it's coming from such a beautiful place of really to give whatever it is. It's almost like this. We don't go there and say, hey, here, learn this from us because we're the best of it. No, we go there and say, guys, we are very good at timing and fighting and manipulating bodies and controlling people on the floor to gain compliance from them. Let me show you what I have. Whatever suits you, you can take. And whatever does not suit you, because at the end of the day, Tom, they are the experts. They know better for their profession what will work for them. My only mission is to expose them for more options so they can do the decision making and choose what's best for them. You see? So it's about exposing them for what is, for more options, instead of saying them what you do. That's not the spirit. Who am I? You see? So it's a whole, the whole collective of it. And then I think that the period on the sentence and the signature is the gratitude that I have towards being safe in this country and giving back to those that makes and allows us to be safe. And like you said, so safe that we forget how dangerous life can actually be. Isn't that cool? Yes. Even though there's this kind of, there's a little energy between community and law enforcement officers because of, you know, just kind of the way that they treat and some misinterpretations that is naturally happening in any kind of relationship. But there, people are so safe that they forget how dangerous it can be, which is pretty cool.
What? So you just talked about giving officers tools to choose from. Can you talk a little bit? So you've trained officers all over the United States. for several years. So you've been exposed to what they bring to the table. Can you talk a little bit about what is a typical officer who doesn't have this extra training get from their department, and the average good police question. Officer who doesn't do, what would you expect them to know in terms of defensive tactics? Because we all assume that, oh, police officers, they know how to fight. They're trained to control people. What type of skills does a typical officer have?
Great question, Tom. And it's important that we say that 100% I'm touching officers all over the United States. But just for the data to be out there, officers comes from outside the country as well, because our program is so well recognized that we have officers from Africa, Switzerland, like Europe, anywhere people just come and learn from us. And to answer your question, is not only to talk about officers in America, it's to talk about all the officers that I get in contact with. And the kind of training that they receive, like you mentioned, that society expects them to be like ninjas and FBI guys and black belts, just people so well trained that all they do is to train defensive tactics and be ready for society. But unfortunately, that's not the reality. Given my experience and the experience that I collect from the people that we touch, is that they have very limited amount of hours for training defensive tactics a year. Some people, they have 1 hour. Some people have that 4 hours of defensive tactics per year. And that means not only jiu-jitsu and ground fighting, that means defensive tactics as a whole. Standing up, strategies to talk to someone inside the vehicle, duty belt training, and all the kind of training. So it's not that much training. It's surprisingly low training. There are some departments that they have 8 hours. There's some departments that have like a weekly thing, but those are rare. The majority of it is that they grab a group of recruits, they pour some information at them, and then I say, okay, you know, make the best out of it and go, because the deployment of the monetarily deployment to this kind of training, it's not the most, it's not the biggest. And not only that, some people that have a little bit of time, they're most of the times or sometimes learning martial art or a way that is not the most effective. Not to say that it's bad. There's some, you know, there's Krav Maga, there's striking arts, there's pressure points. There's a lot of strategies in law enforcement that are very important to have. The thing is that once they learn like a certain, because they have a little bit of amount of time only at their disposal, and they learn that with most of the time some violence and some strategies that are a little more escalating than they escalating, that's something that's not jiu-jitsu. It can be, you know, and it can be detrimental. And so it can create the reality that we have today.
If all you're taught is a very short period of time and it's like punching and hitting with a baton,
yes,
then that's what you're gonna do. If you have somebody, so you've seen lots of people who have not had much training put in a situation under control where they need to where they fight. So if I have no training and I become involved in a physical altercation, even if it's simulated, what are some of the things that people do with no training? Like, how do they behave when they have to fight?
I understand. It's across the board. Law enforcement officers are not any human being that we find themselves in a fight situation, even in training, like you mentioned, is panic. It's abrupt, quick movements based on strength and explosion. And that behavior, it's a very instinctual behavior that we have just to get out of the discomfort. What happens with that is that if you have enough explosion in within, meaning if you have more power than the other person, you might succeed. The problem with that is that when the other person is bigger, or maybe you are already a little tired during the fight and your explosion potential is not as abrupt. Now you're exploding and you're wasting energy. And that's what happened across the board. Like I've mentioned, people fight and they try to figure out a way to escape with no plan, which results in exhaustion, which in a street fight, being exhausted, completely depleted of energy, is the same as being knocked out unconscious. Your brain doesn't work properly. You cannot move and you're just kind of helpless. Mm-hmm. So even though people people very much respect being knocked out. The last thing we want in a fight. I agree. But the other thing that we want to avoid at all costs is complete exhaustion. So what we show officers is how to gravitate from chaos and panic to a certain survivability. Not to say that they will become masters of jiu-jitsu and be able to hold someone down or choke anyone out. No, the proposition is, man, I want to give them officers, I want to give officers tools so they can keep their energy in within themselves, stay safe while the suspect or the other person burn their energy, Tom. Because at the same time that in a fight, the people panic on the defensive side, on the offensive side, people don't behave much different. They're also panicking, but they happen to be successful because they have more explosion and more power. So all I have to do if someone is trying to break in into my house, let's say, let's use that analogy, it's not to go outside and beat them up. All I have to do is to prevent them from entering my shelf protection. And because they try so hard, they burn out. And once they burn out, I can now get up and run from that person, or that from a civilian perspective, right? Just disengage from the fight and survive. Or for the officer to, of course, do that and disengage and survive, but also to find the window of opportunity to control them, subdue, handcuff, put them in the patrol car, and then take them into custody, which that would be the end goal. Right, was that clear regarding the behaviors?
Absolutely. And I know this is one thing that I noticed with a lot of police training is that the goal is to effect an arrest as quickly as possible. But you guys teach it a little differently time be on the officer's side?
Great question, Tom.
Can you talk about a little bit about maybe allowing things to take a little longer? I heard the term windows of opportunity for compliance rather than demanding compliance provided.
Yes, we can talk about that. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about a little bit about that?
So, yes. So the understanding that when two people are fighting, because there's a fear of losing the fight and being knocked out, people want to finish the fight the sooner the better, like the soonest possible. And that goes to civilians and humans, but law enforcement as well, because they want to handcuff and notify the threat the quickest possible. And I completely understand that mindset, but we have to understand what that brings to the table. And if I'm fighting an NFL player, for example, I'm like 200 pounds, 210 pounds, right? I'm a good size human being, 6'5". But imagine I'm fighting a person that is my size, but it's an NFL player, and there's like 300 pounds muscle, right? And that could be this equation that I'm describing, or it could be you, and that Tom, it could be any average size human being with someone bigger. There's always someone bigger than you out there. When I see the bigger person than me, at the first 10 seconds of a fight, that person is like full of power and energy. So what's going to happen is that we're going to collide our energies, and whoever has the most will succeed, like we mentioned before. And with officers, they have sometimes two officers. So we have two people against one, and they have the same mindset. Let's nullify this right now. And then sometimes, because you're fighting like that, you have a less awareness of your energy expenditure and of what's actually happening in a fight. So what happens is sometimes officers lose their balance and the suspect gets up, maybe goes on top of the officer to hit them. Maybe they stand up, go inside a car and run away. Maybe sometimes they go inside a car, grab a gun, and you start utilizing. You see, because I'm fighting this person that is bigger than me with a mindset that I want to show you who is the person in charge and I want to control it right now, I'm fighting them in a place in which they're ready to fight me. So what we suggest is that once you find yourself in a scuffle, your goal is not to win by subduing them and by submitting them. Your goal is to win by exhausting them. And exhaustion is a byproduct of time. I don't care who you are, you're going to be able to fight crazy for 30 seconds. You have 30 seconds in within you. But after 30 seconds, 35 seconds, 50 seconds, they start slowing down, and that happens with everyone, Tom. It's across the board. It's a human behavior. People give it all, and then they stop. And then some people rest, and then they give it all again. But the second explosion is weaker than the first one. Therefore, the third explosion is weaker than the second one, and exponentially, so much that we have something called the 100-second rule. It's in the mindset that before handcuffing the suspect, Tom, we suggest the officers hold them down for at least 100 seconds. Because what we know in the experience in fighting on the streets and fighting in tournaments and fighting MMA, we know that as time goes by, people get more exhausted. Therefore, they get easier to be handcuffed. So if I really want to handcuff someone, Tom, I want to handcuff them after 100 seconds and not in the first 10 seconds. Because in the first 10 seconds, when I grab your wrist, you're gonna twist, you're gonna punch, you're gonna pull, you're gonna do crazy things on me. But after 100 seconds, your spirit is a little demoralized, and your ability to fight is less. Therefore, you're easier to be handcuffed. But I can only wait, Tom. I can only empower people to have this mindset of waiting in a fight once they know what to do. Because if you don't know what you do, you might as well panic. You have a better chance than just you doing nothing. Now, once you have defensive tactics training, and once you have the structure that GST gives to you, you have basic tools. It's not that hard to hold someone that doesn't know how to fight. People have this misconception, Tom, that you need to be a black belt to learn how to fight and to defend yourself. That is not true. You need to be a black belt to defend yourself against a black belt. But in order to defend yourself against someone that doesn't know anything, just a crazy person on the street that's fighting for their life, you all you have to do is know a little bit more than them. Mm-hmm. You see? And especially if you have this mindset, man, I know a little bit more than them. I'm going to subdue them and control. I'm not trying to accomplish anything but to stay alive and to save my energy, because I know that they're burning their energy ineffectively. It's a matter of who manages their energy better. It's not a matter of who causes more damage. Isn't that interesting? And that we find to be a misunderstanding on law enforcement, that, you know, they arrive at the scene, you know, and then rightfully so, they want to nullify the threat quicker because they don't want that to go crazy. Mm-hmm. But by attempting to nullify quicker, you actually are contributing for a crazier fight. While the behavior of approaching, like holding down and pinning the person on the wall or on the floor, just preventing your duty belt from being touched, no weapon grabbing, just weapon retention techniques, just smothering the person with control and effectiveness, and then they burn out, and then you talk to them. Say, hey, my friend, here we are. No strikes, no excessive use of force, no early or premature access for the duty belt, just straight up control and newly find the threat and nullifying the danger. And that's what we want. Then we find the danger for themselves, because the suspect, most of the times, they're not only a threat for the officer and for others around, but also for themselves. And then we nullify the threat for the officer, which is our main goal. So the officer knows a little bit, so they can nullify the threat, handcuff the person in the right time, which is, like you said, there's a certain window that is beneficial, and then go back home safe for the family. That's our primary goal.
If you've never, some people have maybe listening to this have never been in a fight, the feeling, like when I worked as a police officer, and when things were dangerous and it was a real fight on, afterwards, sometimes I found myself, I would throw up. You get these adrenaline surges, and it's very hectic. And what you find is if you train and you prepare and you engage in this type of training, it sort of inoculates you. And then when you find yourself in these situations, you can think more clearly, you can manage the adrenaline, because you're not using all of your energy. You're using the skills you've learned to conserve your energy while they use their energy. And then, like you said, you can talk to them. You can say, okay, do you still want to fight? You know, this is not going good for you, friend.
Why that happened, Tom? You are 100% right in your assessment. And once you know jiu-jitsu, you have more ability to make discernments and take care of the situation more cerebrally than just chaotic. Now, it's interesting that I want to share with you is that there's plenty of studies that I encourage officers or non-officers just to be familiar with that, or just listen to what I'm going to say right now, which is this. we have in our brain a beautiful complexity of anatomy inside of us, right? The brain is an amazing part of our body. And it's divided in many parts. I want to talk about two specific parts right now of our brain, which is the amygdala, which is known as the reptilian brain, or primal fight or flight instinct. And we have our more modern, more evolved part of the brain, which is called the PFC, or prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is responsible for decision-making, for planning for the future, for discernment, for understanding threats, engaging. It's very much like everything that we do as humans, different from the animals, is a function of the prefrontal cortex. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens physically in your body is that when people get into a situation in which they lose the sense of control, that is the trigger. It's important to emphasize that people that lose control or the perception of control, they lose access to the prefrontal cortex, which is an automatic response for the human body to protect the body. So the prefrontal cortex gets shut down, mm-hmm. and the reptilian brain gets activated. That's why you see the same behavior in any kind of animal or any kind of human that is fighting for their lives. It's the reptilian brain responsible for the fight or flight mode, which is abrupt movements, explosion, chaos, more energy, and which eventually leads to survival in some cases, mm-hmm. but in other cases leads to exhaustion. So what once you know jiu-jitsu, and once you know certain techniques to nullify the threat, you can be in a fight with your prefrontal cortex activated, mm-hmm. because you never lost control or perception of control. Isn't that fascinating? That's why we see, we have videos, Tom. This is so crazy. We have videos of officers naturally, and you know, I'm not attacking the behavior, but the behavior is that they go to the scene and they go crazy on the suspect. Just go like a lot of energy, trying to do this old mindset of overwhelming the suspect. Fairly so. I don't judge it. I respect it. But we understand that it can be detrimental for ourselves as officers. So we see officers, we have footage of two officers trying to, you know, overwhelm a suspect. Then a third party officer arrives to the scene a little bit later with jiu-jitsu training. They have the prefrontal cortex activated. He watched and witnessed suspect with no prefrontal cortex because he's being punched and attacked. Officers with no prefrontal cortex because they are, you know, but the best of their ability is trying to overwhelm the person. So this third person arrives at the scene, say, hey guys, step back. I got this. Put a knee on the stomach, which is a technique in jiu-jitsu, or a mount control, a side mount. And they literally push the other officers away with kindness and gentility, with communication. And then they take over of the fight, making safer for the officers that are involved and for the suspect. And you can only do that once you have your prefrontal cortex activated while you are fighting. That's why when I grapple, or when you see some professional martial artists fighting, they look very calm and serene. Mm-hmm. I can be like someone punching me on top of me, and I can be hugging their body, but my eyes look like this. Like, I'm there. You can see that they're there. You don't see like eyes going all over the place. You see a certain serenity. So much that when we watch them, I see that people that don't train martial arts, they watch them. Why? How is they so calm? How can be they can be so cold and precise? And it's almost beautiful to watch, right? You say, man, this person literally knows what they're doing. And that's primarily because of the prefrontal cortex is activated. And yes, because they do have a plan and they have a perception of control that it, for law enforcement, it's a no-brainer. We must share this with them because, you know, it's so crazy because, Tom, just a little more on that, is it's almost, and I want to be very, you know, bold right now, but I want to say that to keep the prefrontal cortex activated is almost more important than the jiu-jitsu techniques. You understand? Mm-hmm. To be in control of yourself and of the fight, it's more important than the jiu-jitsu techniques. But the irony is that you cannot be with your prefrontal cortex activated without the GIST techniques, because they are the ones that slow the fight down, save energy. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
To have access to a part of your brain that other humans do not have while you're in a fight is priceless. And that is backed up by science and articles. It's beautiful.
Absolutely. And it goes, it's something you can build, and it's also something that can go away over time. I know that when I have trained jujitsu regularly, I'm much more calm. I can think, I'm using the techniques. And then if I take a lot of time off and I go back, it's a panic to have a person.
Yes. It's a perishable skill.
And when someone is dominating you physically, I panic, but after time, when I'm being dominant, I'm okay. I think about it's okay at the time.
I see.
And the skill comes and goes. And so it's important for officers, I think, to continue to train over a long period of time regularly. So that the skill is fresh, and it's a very it's a vital skill. One other thing you mentioned was striking. Can you talk a little bit about how you incorporate striking into your training? What role you think it should play for police officers?
100%. We in jiu-jitsu is broad no for no strikes. That's what kind of people have this perception of jiu-jitsu is a grappling martial art, and there are no strikes. That is not true. The jiu-jitsu that is known as no strikes is as more known as the sport jiu-jitsu. And yes, in sport jiu-jitsu, there's no strikes. But when we talk about self-defense and real fighting scenarios amongst any two human beings, strikes are a big part of it. Now, what is the difference between the strikes that are usually known and the strikes in jiu-jitsu? We in jiu-jitsu, we don't want to rely on strikes for power dominance. The reason why is because if I can punch you, Tom, you can most likely punch me. If I'm in punching distance to punch you, I'm in punching distance to be punched. Same with any kind of strikes. Okay, so I don't want to rely on that exchange. But I do want to rely on strikes for distraction. We use very little strikes, but when we use, it's a purposeful strike to distract the person from whatever they are attempting to accomplish. For example, I have the scenario where I mount the suspect and then go for my firearm. We have some weapon retention mechanism and techniques to prevent that from happening. And then once I apply them, one motivation that I would do for the people to let go of my gun, in which I have the control of already with technique, would be to deploy one or two or three strikes, but purposeful strikes in order to nullify that threat instead of knocking the person out and causing more damage than I want to at them or damage at me. Because what people also don't realize, Tom, is that by me striking, it's very exhaustive. If you go to fight and you want to punch people out, it's a lot of work. Not only that, you can be exhausted, but also you can miss a punch and punch the floor and I broke your hand. Or you punch, they tuck the head, you punch their forehead, which is it's a stronger bone than the bone of the hand, and then you break your hand. And the fight keeps on going, you have a broken hand. You see what I'm saying? Another example would be, there's a very common scenario for law enforcement officers, which is the suspect, he's not fighting the officer, but he hides his arms, he lays down on the floor.
The turtle, yes.
To like turtle up and like don't have his hands behind his back. So we have an amazing leverage-based technique on how to remove that arm from in front of their chest with safety and scanning to make sure that there's no objects or any kind of sharp object in their hands. But then once that is accomplished and the technique wants to be delivered, sometimes they can hold their hands and it can be a little, challenging. So what do? One strike to the rib cage or even one pressure point. You see, we're not, we by no means look separate ourselves from the techniques that cause pain and discomfort and immediate strikes. The difference that we use that purposefully, we use them not to overwhelm, but to just strike and to accomplish a plan. The way to understand is that if strikes are my plan, I have nothing else underneath it. So I arrive to the scene and boom, here's my plan, strikes. What we do is that we deliver a different plan, which is the jiu-jitsu techniques. This is your plan, you arrive here, boom. Now, sometimes when you cannot accomplish this, you introduce the strikes, but once you do one or two strikes, you will accomplish your original plan, you see, which is much less stressful to have a plan of, oh, I'm going to strike compliance out of you, or I have a technique that I'll try to accomplish, and when they're not accomplished, boom, one strike, two strikes, distract the person, because strikes can be very distracting.
Yeah.
And then I accomplish. It, same for closing the distance, right? You know, if the person's away, should I just go and close the distance and take the person down, or should I throw one strike or one kick? And then the person gets a little thrown off, boom, and then I find my closeness. And once we're closed, we're safer from strikes from them, and then we can do everything that we've been talking about. Is that clear?
Yeah, so it's something that you're not, you don't eliminate, but you say it's something that should only be used as a tool that you're using to help move along your overall strategy of getting the person in handcuffs, is what the goal is.
Exactly. And once the person understands that, Tom, they use very little strikes, because jiu-jitsu is already so complete that very rarely you will need strikes. But nonetheless, we keep them in the room, but we don't even need them. And how amazing it is that you don't need strikes. It's the same as a duty belt. I don't want officers to go on the street without duty belts. No, I want them to have it, and to have the gun, have the taser, and have whatever they carry. But I want them not never have to use it.
Right.
You see, if they need it, you use it. But if you never have to use it, it's amazing. Same with strikes. I want you to know how to strike, how to purposefully, effectively strike for distraction, but hopefully you never have to use it. And if you have, you're going to use those strikes instead of the duty belt. You see, we're creating urgency layers. Jiu-jitsu, right. Strikes, and then duty belt, instead of just fight, duty belt, or fight, strikes, you see?
Yeah, and there's always the time where it may be required to hit someone with a hammer or a brick. Who knows? If your life is on the line, anything, it's a fight, anything. But the goal is that officers don't go to the extreme of punches and hitting, that they have
all. It's not necessary.
It is not the best tool to get to gain compliance. So
now let me change that, Tom. It is the best tool to gain compliance if you don't have any other tool.
Right. Yes.
You see? So I cannot say that it's not the best tool, because the person that only knows how to strike, that's their best tool. You see? That's why we want to give officers more tools. So then they say, man, instead of, if you have a hammer, Tom, everything is a nail. Tack, 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 tack. You see a screw, you hammer the screw. So I want to give officers the tools. So they pick and choose. And then that would be the best choice.
One thing that I thought was interesting is you talked about, so with firearms, a big thing is managing time, which you already talked about, and distance. So managing yes. distance, and with striking, it's managing distance. Can you talk a little bit how maybe, because people, it may not be intuitive, but how jiu-jitsu is a tool to, and why it's, how it can be used, and why managing distance is important in grappling?
Yes. A good sentence that will sum it up that perfectly is that whoever manages the distance manages the damage. Okay? It's important to understand that in order for a strike to cause pain, it has to be charged. And the coiling of the strike is distance creation. If distance creation gives power to a strike, my job is to do distance managing so distance never gets created, which, as you mentioned, it's counterintuitive for most people. When they're being punched, they want to push the person away and get out. And if you can do that successfully and get out faster than they can pursue you, you win. The problem is that if the person is really committed and you're trying to create space, you are subconsciously helping them, because you're creating a space that they are utilizing to attack. Mm-hmm. So what we do in jiu-jitsu, which it is counterintuitive, but it's the best choice, is to go in and be close to the suspect and to the person that's attacking you. So they're punched, even though they can punch, imagine someone is hugging my body right here. Their head is right here, standing up. Even though I can punch them, my punches are weak punches instead of a full, boom, knocked out punch. You don't see people in UFC or MMA being knocked down by a biceps curl like this. It's always a very well delivered punch with distance. So whoever controls the distance controls the damage. And in order to be proficient in jiu-jitsu, you want to be very aware of that. Even if you want to get out of the fight, okay? Let's assume I want to run away from this person. Person A is chasing person B. My goal is to run away. They're punching me in immediate threat, one arm distance. even if my goal is to run away, I want to go in, thrown off the timing of their punch, and then I disengage. It's magnificent. And you talk a lot about that. You know.
So it's across everything, really, in policing.
Everything, standing on the ground, everything. And manage the distance, manage the damage.
With firearms as well, knowing where you are in relation to the threats.
And
it goes all the way from firearms all the way into when your hands are on a suspect, being aware of distance and having those tools to manage that distance and know where you are, when you're vulnerable.
In relationship to their body, yes. And right. To your point, it goes to weapon retention as well, because once I have full connection of your body, there is this idea that my duty belt is closer to them, therefore it's more grabbable. I agree. But the idea, once I have full connection, I can not only feel his intention going towards my duty belt, but I can apply proper connection techniques to prevent that from happening effectively. And not just kind of grabbing the arm and preventing with distance, you see? My whole body and my whole intention will facilitate that. And the funny part of this, Tom, is that, not funny, but the interesting thing is that you have to experience it. Once you feel it, what we're talking about the connection, because to talk about it is very what do you mean? But once you you go to a class and expose yourself to jiu-jitsu, to a safe training environment that takes care of you, it's not like just Shark Tank and kill each other and let's just beat these people up so they can become tougher. That's not a goal. You were there, you witnessed. It's very much an exploration of studying it and feeling what happens. And once you have a certain feeling like, oh, I'm not spending that much energy. My weapons are safe. This is interesting. And that's what hooks everyone in jiu-jitsu. And that's why jiu-jitsu, there's a crazy growing line regarding dissemination. Everyone wants to do Brazilian and Gracie jiu-jitsu because they have that feeling. And once they have that feeling, my man, they're hooked and they understand efficiency and now they're lifetime practitioners.
You just mentioned something I want to talk about too, is like the feeling of a safe environment. Now, I know someone who's listening to this, like the idea of going in a room with a bunch of people and having them grab you and learning these techniques could be a little intimidating, especially maybe if you're smaller, maybe someone, a female or a female officer. Can you talk a little bit, two things about that? Should they be intimidated? And then is this can small people use these techniques effectively? Can you talk
beautiful about question 100%. It's important that we remember that Hélio Gracie was 140 pounds. Hélio Gracie, they were responsible for shifting the mindset of jiu-jitsu from the old school Japanese jiu-jitsu to survivability. Okay, and every technique that we show, and let's put it this way, the class that we give is for the weaker and smaller person. The class is made for them. Now, bigger people also benefit because there's always someone bigger than them, right? Yes. We talked about that. But the way that the beauty of jiu-jitsu comes from this triumph of human intelligence and leverage over brute strength. And that's what is interesting. If I say, hey, Tom, lift that car up, you cannot do it. But if I give you a lever, you can lift the car up. So the techniques in jiu-jitsu are based on leverage and timing. And they're also based on natural body movements. I don't want to teach anything, or I don't want to say teach. I want to say, I don't want to share anything that is not universally possible for people to apply. I don't want to teach something that it requires extra flexibility or it requires extra length or strength. I want something that my mom can apply, my grandmother can apply, you see? Because it respects principles of jiu-jitsu, which is distance management, energy efficiency, weapon retention for law enforcement, and leverage-based movements. And not only the smaller officer can be open to the Great Survival Tactics class environment, but also the officer that never trained jiu-jitsu before. People say, no, I have to know a little bit to go there. No, the class is explained in a way that the person that never have access to it will be able to fully understand. There's no using terminologies that you don't know, assuming things that you should know doesn't exist. I'm gonna treat you as who you are. And the beauty of that is that the way that we teach the program, because the instructors are so qualified, we teach in a way that the brand new person will benefit, but also the black belts will benefit. We have black belts, brown belts, purple belts, whatever rank they are, they come to your class and they're like, man, these details are amazing. And that's the beauty of teaching the something proficiently, which is you can be so open to the person, the people that don't know nothing, that they don't get left behind. And you can also be complex to the sense that the people that are advanced and know jiu-jitsu, they also get amazed by the techniques. And we cover the whole spectrum. But no doubt, if I'm going to focus on someone, I'm going to focus on the smaller and on the brand new people. Because the purple belts, the brown belts, they already know something. So if I have a choice of time, for example, and I have three details to share, and two advanced and one simple, I'm going to choose the simple one. You see? If it's a time thing, because I'm more concerned about the person that doesn't know anything than with the guy that knows some techniques already. We want to, it's like the chain's only as strong as the weakest link, correct?
Right.
So the class will be made for those people, and I highly encourage them to come and to feel and just to experience. Don't believe me. Go to a class and just ask people that have been to a class before, you see, and just ask them, how was the energy? Did you feel safe? You know, was the techniques plausible to against someone bigger than you? Ask people and they will tell you, and we're going to be ready for you.
And I found that the smaller people, the people who've been doing it a while, the smaller they are, the better their technique is. Because they
isn't that crazy, Tom.
They're they rely on the technique. Whereas, like me, I'm 260 pounds. I muscle things sometimes. Whereas the smaller
people, it's harder to learn.
Yeah. So the smaller people, they learn much. They're better at learning.
It's crazy.
Because it's
it might take a little longer. It might take a little longer for them to actually succeed against a 250 pound person. You see, because they have to literally dial in the technique. But once they get him, I mean, it's better. Now, you, Tom, you don't really need to learn the technique, kind of, quote unquote, right? Like, yeah, you grab it and you push it. And if you do it a little wrong, it kind of works.
It works.
Which is in a way, not good.
Not good.
You know? But
yeah, so if you.
Kinda, you're correct. Yeah.
And I think that's a testimony to that, that the techniques really work, because when you do dial them in, I can go, if someone is 155 pounds and they are a black belt in jiu-jitsu, I can't just do what I want to them. They can control me. They can, and I'm a big, strong, athletic, and I know jiu-jitsu. The skill, when the skills are fully developed, it's fascinating how effective for small people they can be. It's crazy.
It's unbelievable. I think the word is unbelievable, right? It's like, man, how can this person 150 pounds lighter than me can control me? It's fascinating. Yes.
And size does still matter. If the skill level is the same, size matters.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit? So if I'm a police officer in Chicago and I want to, and I work on the defensive tactics team, training officers, and I want to go through your course, the first course. Can you just tell me, like, how long does it last? And then, and what you do, what they would expect.
Yeah. So the first step to do is to look for a training location that's close to you. Okay. So we have on missuniversity.com/GST. You're going to find all the training locations and where the courses will be hosted. Once you find a location that is close to you, the closest one, right? Because people fly all over. But when you find the closest location to you and one that makes sense to your schedule, you're going to go to the class. And the way it works is like this. We have we have 5 days of training, okay? The three first days of training are focused on the techniques. We're going to talk a lot about how to control, how to subdue, how to survive standing on the ground, handcuffing techniques, compliance techniques. It's going to be an amazing learning environment. We have 23 lessons, and every lesson has a variation in within themselves, which there will be amazing variations for all those 23 lessons. And then there's the last 2 days of it. And this is something that people, most of the times, they don't expect, and I want to share that with you guys right now, which is the last 2 days, they're focused on teaching methodologies. Because we teach not end user officers, we teach officers that will teach other officers, we want to give them teaching methodologies, teaching techniques, so they can deliver the technique more effectively to the end user officer. So the choice that we found ourselves in is that we could use the two last days for more drilling and then just trust that they would be able to replicate and disseminate the information on their own personal skill level of teachers. But what we do is that we trust that the officers will keep training because we give them online access. Every class they learn during their week, you're going to have access to the online video so you can review those techniques. I'm going to be teaching with Hiro and Henner online, and you watch it, and you review before class, and then you keep your friends in your department training in, amongst yourselves while you teach those techniques. So I'm not too concerned about training time. Again, I'm concerned about exposing them to options so they can choose five of those 23 techniques, and then they train them over and over again, you see? Mm-hmm. And then they become proficient, and then they teach better. So the two last days are focused on those teaching methodologies, which changed my life as a teacher. And most of the time, the feedback they get is amazing. It's unbelievable that people appreciate it. And a lot of drilling, repetition, and muscle memory, and boom. And then we do some duty belt drilling at Friday. So mm-hmm. people have a grasp on how to actually utilize a training gun and to keep a control of the suspect while wearing it. And we also do blindfold drilling, which mm-hmm. is people blind their eyes. I don't know if you remember that, yep. which is very interesting. You close your eyes. It could be to simulate that there was maybe pepper spray blowback or just maybe scratch or a dark room, whatever it is that happens. You find yourself not being able to see, but jiu-jitsu doesn't care. Jiu-jitsu still is almost better. That's kind of crazy. Once you close your eyes, once you deprive yourself from one sense, the other sense gets enhanced. And what I have to tell is that from all of our senses, sight is the less important one. And also to get your experience there, and then you sweat a little bit, and then we have a wrap-up talk, and then we go from there. And after that, even though that 5 days training week is done, the communication is still real. We have a Facebook group in which all the officers go there to interact among themselves, to share anything that they want to share, or to talk about next potential training locations that we have. We also have the full support at Grace University that we offer. Any question that you guys have online in Grace University, there's a Q&A, most common asking questions, and there's an open blank for you to ask a question. Whatever question that is not answered yet, you ask, and a live instructor will answer that in the next 24, 48 hours. So it's a constant feedback towards any new scenario or any problem. If you have any trouble, you send it as an email. We answer like me and you right now. You just connected with me. I remember I gave you my personal phone on the day. I said, man, if you ever need anything, let me know. And now you text and I'm having this phone call. So because the mission is so real that it doesn't end on those 5 days. It starts with GST, but it doesn't end because now we have certified instructors all over the country sharing jiu-jitsu. And then they because they like the class so much, they send more instructors. And then we're in the same movement. I'm part of the same movement that you are by sharing this video, and everyone is part of the same goal, which is to share defensive tactics with law enforcement.
And so they come to you, they get the basic set of skills. They also get the methodology, how to teach it. They go back into the field. There's support. There's additional training. They can come back for level 2 training. They can come back for more training. They can also seek out a jiu-jitsu school and pretty much anywhere in America now to continue to reinforce their skills. And the goal is for this to grow. I'm going to put some links down in the bottom to your training. And I just want to thank you so much for your time. Is there any thing like sort of parting words or things you'd like to share? I know your time's valuable. I'm going to get you on your way, but any final thoughts on your part?
Tom, if what's coming up for me right now is that there is this, I kind of touched briefly, but I just want to say this. There's this understanding that society have a perception of what acceptable use of force is. And departments individually, they have different policies on what use of force should look like, okay? So it's important that people know that every department has different policies on use of force. And important that departments be aware, you know, society has an expectation of how officers should be treating each case by case. Now, I'm not saying that the perception of society is accurate. I'm saying that they have an expectation, okay? Mm-hmm. So what happened is this. Society has this expectation of how officers should be trained not knowing that the little amount of time and money that is deployed for them to train, okay? So they have a whatever expectation. Officers have this amount of training, okay? Let's call it. And which allows them to apply a fair use of force. The distance between their expectation of society and what officers perform on the street will cause conflict, okay? If an officer does A, B, and C, and society doesn't like it, there's a little noise in the media, and there's a little conflict in between two groups that are actually one only, right? They're working together, they wanna help each other, they don't know how, they're a little, they're confused, so that separation happens. So what is our goal? And what I, why I'm telling you guys this, to educate everyone right now and things that, that we are part of. I want to educate society on how, knowing that officers, they don't have that amount of training, they don't have that amount of time available and money available for them to devote for defensive tactics, which that will raise their consciousness and make their expectation more accurate. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we're training officers because no doubt the officers can train more. And officers are, some of them, most of them, looking for the information and exposing them for growth. So with that, this is also happening. They're also performing closer to what society expects. I don't believe that ever we have the expectation matching police use of force. But I'm a strong believer, and I can see that for a fact, that we can reduce that gap. You follow me, Tom?
Mm-hmm.
So by society having a more accurate perception and expectation of officers are capable of, and officers also walking their way, which they're doing, to be more proficient, we can have a healthy relationship, like I said, amongst two groups that want to help each other, want to cooperate, but sometimes because of misinformation, don't know how. And with that, I just have to say thank you for civilians for listening to this talk, for officers for listening and for exposing themselves for training, and knowing that the majority of America is for law enforcement, and the majority of law enforcement is for society, you see? And with that, we can very much say, man, even though there's some conflict sometimes and some energy, the overall energy is like, man, we are part of the same society and we want to help each other at the best of our ability, so let's do that.
And I think it's a beautiful mission, you know, bringing those things closer together. It improves the trust that exists in society. And that, in the end, it saves lives. So I think you're doing important work. And I thank you very much for your time. I'll put the links below and have a great rest of your week. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you very much, brother.